Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Today we'll be taking a look at your lawn. Larry Mueller here, my guest by way of phone today, Frank Rossi, Associate Professor of Turfgrass Science at Cornell University's Department of Horticulture. Really pleased to have Frank back. He was a faculty member here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison for several years, and then families. Issues, I think. Would that be right, Frank? Would family issues have been the reason for your returning to Cornell?
One goes where one wife says one must go, Larry.
Okay.
There was a job here. My wife is from Central New York. I'm from the New York City area. So it was the only thing that was going to tear me away from Madison was family.
Well, I tell you, it's really good to hear your voice again, Frank, and to talk with you about lawns. And you've been looking a lot at sustainable lawns over the last few years.
Yeah, let me stress that since I've gone, you know, John Steyer and now Doug Soldat there at Madison are doing also some great work in this area. We're doing some as well. And the idea, Larry, has been that, you know, everybody's worried, you know, certainly the scientific community has got pretty convincing evidence that the climate is changing. And we know that our contribution to that by emitting carbon, you know, emissions primarily through fossil fuel use is a big part of that. And we started to look at the lawn as a way of trying to understand how people could do things to help the environment right in their yard. From a climate perspective, and looking at the lawn as a place where carbon gets trapped, right? Because the grass plants are trapping carbon dioxide or taking it out of the air to produce food for themselves. But at the same time, we burn a lot to mow, to fertilize, to use pesticides, to water. What we want to do is help people have the lawn that they want and at the same time think about it from a sustainable perspective by not, you know, by essentially trapping more carbon in the grass, in the plants, than they would be otherwise emitting.
As you obviously been at Cornell now a few years, are the turf grass problems or issues you see at Cornell about the same as the ones you recall from Madison or from Wisconsin?
Yeah, almost identical, particularly where I am here in central New York. Now, New York is a fairly big state. We've got the maritime climates, you know, in New York City and out on Long Island, and then, you know, the climates in the Adirondacks, which are very similar, likely, you know, to northern Wisconsin, where I used to travel. But I would say, in general, you're a touch bit colder, but in general, the problems are exactly the same.
Well, we have callers online who want to visit with you, and I want to give Haley a chance because Haley's been waiting quite a while. Haley, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hi, this is Haley. I have a question about, like, you know, they were saying, like, saving the environment. So if you get fake grass, is that not, like, fake, but,
turf, you mean?
Yeah, yeah, like you buy it and you put it on.
Yeah.
And does that wreck it?
Yeah, well, let me tell you two things. Well, one of the things we think about is not just the carbon or energy you burn to manage the lawn, but also, like, for example, you have to burn energy to produce fertilizers. And, for example, when you put in synthetic turf, there's been an enormous amount of carbon emitted to produce that plastic, number one. And number two, one of the great things about lawns is that they have a real cooling effect. The natural cooling effect that grasses can have on the environment because they release water, release moisture from the surface. And what we're finding and what studies have shown in places where they put synthetic turf or xeriscaping or stones, that typically air conditioning bills, for example, really increase. In Phoenix, they did a study that shows where they didn't have grass, power bills went up 20 to 30%. So the cooling benefits that you get from the lawn really probably offset anything you might get from a synthetic turf or you know, like stone or some other form of vegetation. Plus, most things are going to run off that plastic grass, whereas a normal lawn, things are going to be held on there pretty tightly and prevented from getting on the pavement and contaminating the waterways.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so what could you do to help the environment by, like, would you not cut it as short or keep it longer or, like, to help collect that carbon?
Yeah, very good. The first thing you want to do is to try to figure out how you obviously want to mow the lawn as high as you can set your mower. That's a pretty standard recommendation that we've been making for many, many years. You want to mow it really high so that the roots go into the soil really deeply. But the other thing is, because one of the biggest ways we emit carbon into the atmosphere is by mowing, if you're using a gas mower, certainly if you're using an electric or a push mower, it's not as big of a deal. But certainly for a gas mower, you want to mow as little as possible. And we've been really doing this in our research and out at my, I'm not even doing it at my own house, where I use now the kind of plugged mower test. I wait until I really think the mower's going to get plugged before I get out there and mow. And I've already cut back my mowing 50% this year in what's been a fairly wet and actively growing season. So, Haley, the most important thing you can do to help your lawn, help the environment, is mow it really high and try to mow it as little as possible, but still that it has the look that you like.
All right. There you have it, Haley.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And it was Haley from Rochester, Minnesota. Let's go to Ben from Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. Hi, Ben.
Good morning. This year, I made my New Year's resolution to get off using gasoline, and that includes my yard. And I found about a month ago I was using my home-built electric car to ironically drive to the gas station to fill a jerry can with gas to come back home for my gasoline-riding lawnmower. And I thought, boy, this is just absolutely ridiculous. And I looked around, and I was able to find an old electric riding lawnmower. They used to be made by General Electric in the 70s. I bought it. I'm restoring it. Needed a bunch of new wheel bearings and things like that. And I put three 12-volt batteries in there, like a deep cycle trolling battery, and it works great. And not only that, I have a 45 watt solar power panel, and I hooked it up to the lawnmower, and it works great. I can mow the lawn, and then I park the lawnmower right by the solar panel and hook the batteries up to it, and a couple days later it's all charged back up again.
Yeah, this is, and you know, it's funny, over the last few years we've been getting more and more people sending in stories just like this. And, you know, especially the fact that you've kept it off the grid with the solar panels. One of the things we worry about sometimes, if everybody starts plugging stuff in, right, because they want to, you know, not burn fuel at their house, but they are then on a grid where they're burning coal to power things, you know, that necessarily isn't always helping. So I think, and we've heard a lot of these ideas, a lot of homeowner-scale battery-operated mowers that you can buy are really good. And I think this kind of innovation is exactly what I think is going to help us kind of get through this transition away from the fossil fuels.
Ben, thank you. Great idea. It took a little bit of work. We had a power mower. Frank, and a year ago, so it's been 2 years now that we've had a push mower. And we have a relatively small lawn, so we just use Larry Power or Renee Power.
Well, until your daughter gets old enough, and then you'll use daughter power.
Yeah, then it'll be Emily Power. But it works pretty well, but it doesn't, you know, cut quite as nicely, I guess, as a power rotary mower might, but it works well enough for us.
Yeah, a lot of people, I mean, those push-type mowers are not ideal sometimes for cutting grass higher. They actually work pretty well for cutting lower, but not so much for cutting higher.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Let's let our listeners join in here. If you have a question or comment for Frank Rossi as we talk the lawn today, we've been talking lawn issues with him. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org. And let's turn to Camille in New Berlin next. Hi, Camille.
Hi, Hi. Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about clover and both the yellow and the white clover and looks like the purple clover now, and also African violets. I was very successful weeding by hand the last couple of years, clover and creeping Charlie and this other invasive kind of white flowered plant that came into the yard and reseeding. But this year my efforts are going to waste because it looks like I've attracted voles and field mice, and that every time I put down seed, I'm getting nothing in the bare spots, and then the weeds just take over. So help me out. My neighbors think I'm nuts for doing this by hand. They keep saying, spray it, and I keep saying, I can get a handle on it. And I'm losing the battle.
Yeah, and I think this is fairly typical of, hand weeding, and there actually have been studies looking at hand weeding, although I have to admit, I've never heard anybody hand weed clover before. Mostly people talk about hand weeding dandelions. The problem with clover is the extensive above-ground runners that it has.
Right, the root system is phenomenal.
Really hard to get out. So, one of the things we know about clover is a lot of people have actually gone back to planting clover in their lawn because it has the ability, oddly enough, to trap nitrogen from the atmosphere, which then helps the rest of the lawn stay green. It was very common in the early 70s to have clover in a typical lawn mix as a way of reducing fertilizer use. So maybe you can tell your neighbors that you're leaving the clover in so you can use less fertilizer.
But my grass is dying. I think the nitrogen is because of dead grass.
So are you saying you're having a hard time reseeding these areas?
Yes, it looks like I seem to have attracted a wide variety of voles and a raccoon, and in the evening these animals come out and feed in the very areas where I've put seed down.
No, I wonder what you're talking about, and I don't know, I don't know that you have this problem too much yet in Wisconsin, but what you're describing is very typical of what we see here with white grub problems, where we have little white grubs in the soil that the local animals come by and try to dig up for food. And even when they're not there, these mammals have memory, and they remember where they had a meal, and they'll typically come back and have that meal. Now, I know you have some white grub issues that have come into Wisconsin since I left, but I don't know how severe it is, but what you're describing, because they won't necessarily come out for the seed. They're really scavenging. I mean, that's not really a full meal for them. They're looking for something juicy when they're coming out, and typically a grub is going to be more substantial for them than some grass seed. So what you're describing sounds almost like some kind of an insect issue. Not so much because, if clover was growing there, plants were growing there, I don't see any reason why grass seed wouldn't grow there if it's given the right amount of moisture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what do you suggest I do for the grub? And I'll take my answers off the air, or the insect if I have an insect problem.
Yeah, I don't know. First of all, I'd go into that area and start digging up to see if you actually have the grub problem. And generally, if you do, now would be a good time if you wanted to make, an insecticide application, you could do that. But again, I don't know how severe grub problems are, but certainly in Wisconsin, I would certainly look, dig down a little bit, and see if you find these little white worms. They look like little white grubs. And see if you have them there before I did anything to stop the animals from coming. And of course, then, you'd have to do some kind of trapping or other kinds of things to keep the animals away if you didn't want to use the insecticide.
Frank Rossi, our guest, associate professor of turfgrass science at Cornell University, Department of Horticulture. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking a look at sustainable lawn issues today. How is your lawn growing? Frank Rossi, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Frank's an associate professor of Turfgrass Science at Cornell University in the Department of Horticulture. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 with your question or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Frank, we had an email from Mike in Green Bay. It says, we have an area of our lawn that's been fenced and we moved two horses onto it. This area is sectioned and we do rotate the horses for feeding. Is there a grass that can be planted that will recover faster and be more durable for livestock feeding for horses?
Yeah, well, this is just a little out of my area, but it's funny. We got a question from the New York Racing Association that runs Aqueduct, Belmont, and the Saratoga racetracks, and they had this question also, and what we recommended that they seem to be happy with so far has been tall fescue. But it's very important that when you buy tall fescue seed for horses, for example, that you make sure it's free of endophytes. Endophytes are basically a fungal organism that grows inside the plant that will create animal malady if the animals consume too much of it. So it's really important because you'll get really rapid recovery of the tall fescue. It'll hold up well under the wear and tear of horses. But it's important that you get it endophyte free.
And so how do you determine that?
You can specify that when you go to the farm co-op.
Okay.
Saying that you want tall fescue for pasture and specify that you want endophyte free, and they produce seed just like that.
All right, let's take some more calls. Carl in Green Bay, we're on to you now.
Thank you for the opportunity. I'm a home builder up in Green Bay, you know, building in these new developments, and I see all the neighbors hiring these services, and they have great lawns, excellent lawns, golf course-type lawns. But I'm trying to do it without the chemicals. I often use myself as a guinea pig. For my customers, I've been using recycling my drywall and then spreading gypsum, because so much of the soil is really full of clay, and the gypsum, I'm hoping, will break that down a bit. I'm also spreading sand around in the bare spots to try to get that to blend in over time. Just wondering about what kind of things I can do. I have not put any weed and feed on quite yet. I planted the lawn last fall. It is full of weeds. And I'm trying to attack the weeds through better soil. Looking for suggestions.
Great. Well, I'm pleased to hear that there's home builders in business somewhere. I was under the impression that the home builders everywhere were out of business in the last few months.
They're remodelers now.
They're remodelers now.
Well, this is a great question, and I think it goes right to the heart of what a sustainable lawn can be, and that is, obviously, we want to start from the ground up. Certainly a healthier soil, or at least a well-drained, rich soil, loamy soil, is certainly going to sustain a healthier lawn than a compacted, poorly drained soil. But that's not to say you can't have a decent lawn on a lousy soil. Heck, you know, grass grows on sidewalks, so it's not like grass can't grow anywhere. But it's not as competitive with the weeds when it doesn't have a good soil condition. So, that said, you know, the problem once you get the weeds established in there is that they're hard to get out, as we heard from the previous caller, by pulling them. So some kind of selective or non-selective herbicide to kill everything off and redo it. What we recommend a lot around here, as opposed to the gypsum or the sand, is the use of a well-matured compost. A lot of communities have good yard waste, or if you live probably in Green Bay, there's probably a couple of dairy farms up there still. I don't know. There certainly were when I was around. A lot of good dairy compost could work at establishment. You want to, you know, you want to incorporate that compost in, you know, to a 4 to 6 inch depth, and that's really going to solve the heavy clay problem. There's a lot of research about this, where they've incorporated a really good manure-based compost into existing, you know, clay soils that have really enhanced lawn quality. And the beauty of that is they don't seem to have to fertilize it for the first couple of years because there's so much nutrition in that compost. So as opposed to, you know, grinding up wall board and sand and all these other things, what I would recommend is you go in there, kill off that existing vegetation, find a good compost, send it off to the Cooperative Extension Office, have them do a test on the compost for you to make sure it's well matured, and then incorporate that into the surface, and I believe we'll be thrilled with the results.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Let's turn to Tom in Eau Claire next. Tom, thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
While I'm all for conservation and trying to reduce as much impact on the environment as we can, a few moments ago you were referring to raising the mower up as high as we can and reducing our mowing times per year to reduce pollution and things like that. I got to think from a common sense perspective that burning a quarter of a gallon of gasoline over an hour while one mows their lawn has got to be literally a drop of a raindrop in an ocean of pollution. I can't imagine that even these old lawn boys that were two-stroke or two-cycle engines, which no one really uses anymore, really has that much of an effect on our environment relative to coal plants and eight-cylinder and six-cylinder gasoline engines driving down the highways.
Yeah, and, you know, it's it's one of the great things I miss about Wisconsin, I have to tell you, is the common-sense approach that most of you often used to take with me, which is, let me say, of course, that when you consider, we can even go bigger, let's consider, you know, even if we did everything right in the United States, if China and India keep burning coal, whatever we do here, one argues, might not have enormous contribution. But should that mean, I guess one could argue then, should we throw up our hands and do nothing? Now, I guess if we go right back to your point, I do think that in, you know, people should be contributing and can be contributing in their front yard with simple things like not mowing as much. And, you know, if that means I know I can cut my mowing easily by a 30% just by going from a 2-inch height of cut to a 3-inch height of cut. So, and most people, the average homeowner, won't even notice that. And in general, the lawn will be able to tolerate drought better, crowd out weeds better. So I don't think I'm asking for the average homeowner to do something that's radical, rather simply by raising it up an inch from 2 inches to 3 inches, you can make that little contribution to the overall environment.
Well, I wonder how many lawns there are in the United States, or even in Wisconsin. There must be at least a million lawns.
Well, there's in New York State, there's 3.2 million acres of turf. And so we are, I mean, I think, again, to the caller's point, each lawn itself probably doesn't contribute a lot, but all the lawns collectively that are getting mowed probably contribute significantly. But still, I would imagine, and as the caller stated clearly, two-stroke engines are much worse than four-stroke. So you know, ones you got to mix gas and oil with, like your weed whackers and things like that, they are much worse for emitting carbon than the four-stroke engines we use now, where you have separate gas and oil receptacles. So collectively, it's probably a bigger deal, but individually, obviously, it's probably not.
All right. Thanks again, Tom, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to go to Dave in Eau Claire next. Dave, thank you for calling. Hi.
Glad to be here. My question deals with this. We live on the north side of Eau Claire. Our lot is about a half an acre, and 5 or 6 years ago, I committed to gradually converting my lawn into prairie grasses and flowers. I now have about 23 species growing. Prior to this, people walked by with their dogs and their kids. No one took a look. People stand and stare now. How far do I take this? I want to minimize my runoff. I want to increase the capacity for the lawn to feed bees and butterflies, hummingbirds, and so forth. And I want to continue to make a statement.
Yeah.
And it's something we're actually doing in our cabin, too, because 4 years ago, we quit mowing. The north began to change. Many people tell me in wildlife and fisheries management when the power mower came into existence and suddenly became an easy thing to do at the cabin.
Right. This is really great news. And, of course, this is happening on a broad scale everywhere from, just homeowners that maybe have an acre or two that, really don't want to mow as much, to golf courses, which are, putting 3 to 10 to 20 acres wholesale into no-mow or naturalized or, as you're showing, deliberate prairie areas. This is really spectacular to hear, and I think in a lot of cases makes a lot of sense. Now, that said, your own researchers there at the UW-Madison, John Steyer, in the Department of Horticulture, have actually looked at some of these prairie areas for their ability to minimize runoff and things like that. And one of the things, and I'm sure you observe this, one of the things about naturalizing these areas or establishing a prairie from scratch is it's not as easy in the first few years. And I don't know if this was your experience, but our experience has been that you have to be very deliberate, and there is some management that you do in the first 3 to 5 years where density is not always very good. Maybe you've got to use transplants to get some of the plants in. And a lot of times when those prairies are thin early on, if they're on a sloped area, like, for example, in a little community like Madison, and there's a lot of paved surface, runoff can actually be fairly significant in the early stages of this. So I think I absolutely support the idea that you shouldn't be mowing everything. And a lot of times what we tell guys, and we've been working with this with our state golf courses here in New York, is to try to reduce the amount of mowed area by 30 to 40%, realizing that the playable surface of a golf course is at most 30 to 40% of the land on the property. That leaves a lot of land to naturalize, and I think your approach, also the what we call the ecosystem service that it does by enhancing the wildlife, giving you some plant diversity, there's an enormous number of benefits there. And, I love the idea of a nice-looking lawn, but I don't believe you need to have 2 acres around your house. I think there's a lot of options that you can implement, such as what you're talking about, to help the whole landscape be more sustainable.
Yep. Thank you, Dave. Appreciate your call.
Yeah, well done.
Gene and Ripon will turn to you next. Hi, Gene.
Hi. Hey, thanks for the program. Very useful information. I have a question. I'm a very unorthodox lawn keeper in the city of Ripon. On the edges where it's seen from the streets, I mow once every couple of weeks. But inside of my property, which is surrounded by bushes, I just let things go. And so I've got a lot of clover, Queen Anne's lace, all kinds of other stuff. Doesn't bother me. I think some of them are, those so-called weeds are very lovely. I mow about, four times a summer. But what I noticed, and I'm very curious about, is Creeping Charlie. I love it. I think it's a great ground cover. It's low. You never have to mow it. It's got fragrance. It's got flowers. It's got everything you need. It looks like a lawn. So tell me about Creeping Charlie. How can I get more of it?
Well, a lot of people want to know also about how to get rid of it, too. I've got a couple.
I don't. I want more of it. I love it.
All right.
Well, I remember Larry, we had a guy on many years ago who called in and talked about how he used to make ear from his ground ivy or Creeping Charlie, because another word for it is gill over the ground, and this guy called in and talked about making gilly beer. So maybe we need to find out who that guy was and see what he's doing to get enough gill over the ground or Creeping Charlie to make some gilly beer. But, generally, anything you do, we find ground ivy, in a variety of situations, from fairly wet to fairly dry, shady to full sun. But what I can tell you is if you really want to do it, take pieces of it and little, you know, cut up little pieces of the plant and plant them in different parts of the yard, and they'll reestablish. You can vegetatively propagate Creeping Charlie. I'm not sure you'd be telling your neighbors you're doing that, but in general, you can cut little pieces of the stem and put it in the ground, and it will reestablish and grow in those areas.
And on the other side of the fence, I have two people who have emailed to say, how do I get rid of Creeping Charlie? What do I do? I can't get rid of it.
Well, you know, this was a common question, and I'm sure John and Doug get this question when they're on with you, Larry. It's still a question that we get, and to be honest, I'm not entirely sure why it's still an issue, because even when I was there, 13, 14 years ago, there are two critical times when just about any over-the-counter herbicide will work. We had enormous success with anything that has 2,4-D in it, but if you use a product that has the active ingredient triclopyr, T-R-I-C-L-O-P-Y-R, triclopyr, if you apply it at full bloom in the spring, which is usually around mid-May, or immediately after the first frost in the fall, we had success year after year getting 100% control. And one of the things we tell a lot of our people is, you know, wait until early October, even mid-October in some cases. If you still get a 50-degree day, you know, at that time of year, applying the herbicides at that time, you won't see them work at all that fall. But the following spring, the ground ivy will be gone.
All right. There you have it. Let's go to Mark in Wisconsin Dells next. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I've got a great way to get moles out of your yard.
Move!
Yeah.
You take a rat trap, because those moles are pretty large, some of them, and a mouse trap won't quite do it. You take a rat trap and you bait it with fried bacon, and then you go out to the mole run, you poke a hole in the run so that it's open, and you place the trap next to the hole and cover the whole thing with a wash tub, and it works like a charm.
Yeah, and I think that's a great idea, and I think it goes to the most important thing that any wildlife or person would tell you, that the most effective way to deal with moles is trapping. I don't believe we've come up with anything to eliminate them as effective as trapping.
Well,
so
I've caught
that strategy works any way that enhances the trapping. Some guys like using those piercing traps.
Right.
I've
caught two maybe in the last 25 years that we've lived here, and I found out about this method about a week ago, and I think I've caught a dozen or 15 of them.
So what do you think is the key, the bacon grease?
Well, I think they like the smell of the bacon, but I think when you put a tub or a bucket over it, it confines the smell so that it goes down into the hole, and they can't resist it.
That's a great idea.
So you poke a hole in the runway, and you put the rat trap under a tub.
Right, so that the tub and the hole are covered so the mole can come out, you know, and get at the bacon.
Right. And then it's curtains for the mole.
Yeah, it works great. But I would recommend a rat trap, because mouse trap just doesn't seem to do it.
No, it's not big enough, and they can be fairly good size.
Yep.
All right.
How about that, Larry? The Ideas Network.
All right, Mark. Thank
right,
you.
Thanks
a lot for that call. I bet you a lot of people are going to be trying that. Let's go to Tom and Sibieski. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Larry. I got a question. I've got huge oak trees. I've been cutting my lawn at 2.5 to 3 inches. In fact, I haven't cut it for a month. I've got I used to have a real thick grass. My friend used to come over and do the applications, and he quit doing it because he quit his job with all the lawn care stuff. And I've got fine fescue underneath my big oak trees, and I've got a lot of shade, but my grass is thinned out immensely, and I've got kind of a sand underneath the topsoil, which is about maybe 3 inches, and my sand pH is like 5.3 underneath. I was wondering if I lime my one neighbor down the street put a ton of lime down. His yard looks pretty good, and he's been spraying weed be gone on it. And is what I've been doing, too, is just working areas with putting new seed in. I was wondering, is there anything else I could be doing, or is the lime a good idea?
Well, with the pH, okay, a couple of things. Of course you realize growing grass under trees, even with the fine fescues that are certainly tolerant of the shade, it sounds like you recognize that you've already got some of the limitations there with low light.
Yes.
So, yes, I do think with a pH of 5.3, that liming will definitely help you. But I don't know, I certainly wouldn't recommend you go crazy. If you can get it from 5.3 to 5.7 or 5.8, I think in general the studies have shown, lower pH levels, you typically have less weed invasion. A lot of our common broadleaf weeds aren't as successful at lower pHs. And so consequently, by liming too much, you might create an environment really conducive to that, whereas just a little bit of lime to kind of get that soil in a little bit better balance so that the plant can access the nutrients better is a good first step. What I would say is send in your soil to the Wisconsin Extension Service, look at their lime recommendations, bring it up to like 5.7 or 5.8, do some more seeding with the fine fescues, and I think you'll be happy with the results there.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. And we'll turn to Ed in Madison next. Ed, hello to you. Ed, have we got you there? Oh, I think we lost Ed. Ed had a question about the grass in Yankee Stadium.
Well, it's funny about the grass in Yankee Stadium because I had the opportunity to specify the grass in Yankee Stadium.
Is that right?
That is right. My old college roommate is the groundskeeper there. Danny Cunningham's been there for almost 20 years now. And since I've been back, even when I was in Wisconsin, we used to chat all the time. And when they decided to do the new ballpark, I got hired as the lead turf consultant and was involved in specifying the grass. It's a blend of three Kentucky bluegrasses that were produced in a sod farm in southern New Jersey. And, we just did a bunch of plowing through some data and picked three varieties. And you can actually go to your local Home Depot and buy the grass that they sell at Yankee Stadium, or you can go online and get the actual bluegrass varieties that are used at Yankee Stadium.
That must have been a kick.
That was a kick. Yeah, it was great. It was really, as a lifelong Yankee fan, I grew up, not far from there. It was just really a wonderful time. Matter of fact, opening day, I was honorary groundskeeper for the day, got my groundskeeper outfit, and I got to change out the bases. At the bottom of every inning, I ran across the field and changed first base at the bottom of every inning. So it was a real highlight to be part of that. Of course, it's really good now that they're 3.5 games ahead of the Red Sox, so everybody's happy here in Yankee land.
Well, Ed in Madison is back. Ed, hi. Did you hear all that?
Yes, I did.
And did you have another comment?
Oh, I just want to know how they came to the selection of the grass for the stadium.
Yeah,
it's a good question because obviously we looked at a bunch of data that would give us, we wanted to have a bluegrass that was, of course, had to look really good. They're on TV, 80 nights a year at Yankee Stadium, so obviously it had to have a good dark green color. But one of the critical things we added to this mix this year, this time, was a grass that actually, one of the varieties that gave us good spring color. One of the challenges Danny has there is, sometimes opening day can be March 31st.
Yeah.
And I remember a few years ago, they were blowtorching ice in the warning track, getting ready for opening day. So we wanted a grass that would green up really quickly. And sometimes the best bluegrass varieties that we use are very slow to green up in the spring, but they're great dark blue-green through the summer and the fall. So we put in some varieties that were one particular variety named Cabernet that was really good for a spring color. But other than that, I actually don't recall. recall the other two or three that we used, but that was one of the critical aspects. Plus, you know, you want to have good disease resistance so you don't have to spray as much. And, you know, as much as it is, as much as it can be, we tried to make it as, you know, as low maintenance varieties as they could be.
All right. Thanks, Ed, for calling. Appreciate it. Our guest today, Frank Rossi, Associate Professor of Turf Grass Science at Cornell University, Department of Horticulture. As we talk about lawn issues and zeroing in a little bit on sustainable lawn issues with him. You can join us at 800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263. I'm sorry, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Again, it's 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Talking lawns today with Frank Rossi. Frank, we had an email about no-mow grass options for some lawn areas. This person happened to be up around Door County, but
yeah.
no-mow.
Yeah, we got, when I was there in Wisconsin many years ago, we started having conversations with Neil DeBole, who runs Prairie Nursery there in Wisconsin. And Neil had just started with this no-mow mix, which is really nothing more than a collection of fine leaf fescues, hard and sheep's fescues primarily. These are the really fine-bladed grasses. And, you know, we've had a lot of success. Matter of fact, Larry, we've been converting parts of the Cornell campus over the last couple of years to try to improve the sustainability here by not mowing as much, incorporating some of these fescues in. And we've had just enormous positive responses from the students, and more importantly, from the parents who are paying the bill.
Yeah.
To the no-mow areas we've gone to. One of the things I like about these grasses is that, you know, there's a lot of different ways to do them. For example, if you plant these no-mow mixes, if they are mostly fine fescues, which the ones I'm familiar with and we've worked with are fine fescues, if you plant them, you can put your whole yard into it and still have, because they'll tolerate mowing at 2 to 3 inches. They'll tolerate being mowed at 4 to 6 inches, maybe 3-4 times a year. And then there's areas you can let go just as a meadow. And, you know, oddly enough, I'm a visiting faculty member at the Ag University in the south of Sweden, where I go and teach 5 weeks a year now. Mm. And I visit golf courses there, and, you know, they're much more sustainable with their golf over there than we are here. I've visited several golf courses that are completely fine leaf fescue. Tees, greens, fairways.
Oh, boy.
Intermediate rough and far rough, all one species of grass. And I think the idea of no-mow is going to catch on here more and more as we start to think about the lawn in a different way. And I think if they are these collection of fine leaf fescues, and I think it's important to check that they are, you have that flexibility to mow and get different looks and have the same grass kind of doing different things in your landscape.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Barbara in Milwaukee, we turn to you now. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. You guys have mentioned some positive aspects of you know, having lawn, but I was wondering what the bottom line is. Should we really be segueing away from lawns?
That's a great question, and let me say this. I think that lawns serve a really important part of the urban-suburban landscape, particularly where we've got a lot of paved surface that, like in Madison, for example, and in other places where the storm sewer system dumps right into the surface water bodies. There's no question about the fact that dense vegetation, of which lawns are an important part of, are an important part of those kinds of landscapes to kind of prevent things from getting into the surface water bodies. But that said, number one, I think a diversified landscape that maybe has less lawn could be a good thing. I mean, I don't know that you need a whole acre, 2 acres to mow all the time. That maybe the more diversified that has some meadow, some gardens, some ornamental plantings could be a good thing. And the other thing is, and I think this is the critical part, is that we don't have to be a nut about our lawn. I mean, the most important part of a good lawn that we can tell from an environmental perspective is that it's dense. Now, if you have a little bit of weeds in there, I prefer that you didn't have any crabgrass, because crabgrass is an annual that leaves soil bare in the spring, and that creates a runoff problem. But maybe some clover, even a little bit of ground ivy, the occasional dandelion plant, maybe a weed here or there isn't too much of a problem, and we don't have any evidence yet to suggest that a few weeds are a problem, but certainly a dense vegetation is critical. So the bottom line is, I don't know that we want to eliminate lawns, but I do think we want to be, have them in the right places and manage them in a more sustainable fashion, and maybe, not be so nutty about killing every weed or killing every insect or killing every fungal disease that grows in there.
Especially concerned about how lawns are construed as deserts to bees, and we have so much lawns, and there just isn't a diversity there for a lot of other animals.
Well, you'd be surprised at the diverse. I mean, again, a mowed lawn certainly, is not likely to have the same diversity as a meadow might have, where obviously mowing imposes a certain ecological stress that not mowing doesn't. But that said, again, what I'm trying to say is there's a functional aspect to lawns from a water quality perspective in urban, suburban landscapes that I think we don't want to discount. And in simple terms, I'm saying don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, that there is still some value to this functional part of a lawn that I think is worth keeping.
All right. Thank you very much, Barb, for calling. I appreciate your comments. And Stephen Mazzomani, we turn to you next. Hi, Steve.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I'm out looking at my, quote, lawn, unquote, right now. We bought this house several years ago, and it has about a two-acre front lawn, which the previous owners had mowed entirely. And I thought this was crazy. So I just am mowing a small patch of it, and the rest of it is kind of growing up. But I don't know what kind of grass was in there before, but what I'm mowing even is very sparse, and this is on a west-facing slope, and it's very dry and very sandy soil, so it's very hot and dry site. I'm wondering what alternative to kind of conventional lawn and I might have, and I'm hearing that about this no-mow option, and that sounds like that might work for me, but it's a very dry site. Would that work?
Yeah, well, the issue, once the fescues become established, these no-mow finely fescues become established, they'll do fairly well in these dry conditions. They won't be green. I mean, I think one of the things that's critical is as we move to maybe a more diversified lawn landscape, that, we might have to give up the idea that it's got to be green all the time. The challenge you're going to have is establishing the grass into those areas, because you're going to be really reliant on natural rainfall.
Yeah.
So generally what I tell you is, around the end of August into the Labor Day period is to start dispersing seed out there, and unless you're able to, run a hose or something, rely on natural rainfall and recognize it may take you a year to get more fescues in there. But what you're saying that's good news for establishing these grasses is that you have bare soil.
Well, no, I don't. There is grass there now, but it's just kind of sparse.
Right, so it's sparse, which means in between is bare soil, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So where you have the bare soil, if you get the seed in contact with that bare soil, it'll be very successful in establishing, provided that you have some water. And once it gets established, you should be home free.
So you need to do a little watering to begin with.
Yeah, we're in one of our wettest summers ever. How's the weather out there?
We've still got several parts of Wisconsin that are pretty dry.
Yeah, because we had the second wettest June in the history of weather records this past year. So it's been a real wet spring, wet summer for us, which is very odd. It was a dry spring. So that's going to, you know, going to create challenges for establishing these grasses from seed.
What about core aeration? When's the best time to core aerate?
Well, you know, Larry, I don't think the average homeowner in Wisconsin needs to core aerate. In general, if you have a really compacted clay soil, you know, maybe some coring would help to kind of break it up a little bit. Usually we see thatch problems, that organic matter that accumulates at the surface. We see that often with heavily fertilized bluegrass lawns, a lot of times commercially managed lawns. They may need to be core aerified, and we'd recommend that you did that probably around the Labor Day time.
Okay, that makes good sense. Frank Rossi, our guest, Associate Professor of Turfgrass Science at Cornell University's Department of Horticulture, here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking a look at your lawn on this edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Frank Rossi, Associate Professor of Turfgrass Science at Cornell University's Department of Horticulture. Really happy to have Frank back with us and certainly ready to answer your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or by email at talk@wpr.org. And Frank, we have Nathan from Elkhorn with a question. Let's go right there. Hi, Nathan.
Hi. I put in a new lawn this year. I went with pretty much an all bluegrass blend. I had it mostly in last week of May, first part of June. We didn't have much moisture for a while. Now we've gotten some more. I watered a lot when I was first establishing. Now I'm getting a lot of yellow and brown again, and I'm wondering, I haven't really watered much because we have had some rain. Is that just because that's a cool season grass and that's going to perk up again as we come into September? And what else should I keep in mind for coming into winter on the new lawn?
Yeah, good question. One of the things for sure that as soon as you make the decision to have a Kentucky bluegrass lawn, I'm assuming it was 100% bluegrass lawn, or was it partly other grasses as well?
No, the seed mix was, like, I think it was 99% three different blends of bluegrass. I'd have to look, but fescues or anything in it.
Right. So you know, the bluegrass is, you know, generally not going to like the dry conditions that well. It will go off color, but a lot of times when you're establishing a new lawn, those first few months, maybe it needs a little extra fertilizer to help the roots get down a little bit to get to a complete density. It's really slow growing. So I think obviously what you're seeing is a little bit of, you know, probably response to the dry weather. Bluegrass, what a lot of people don't realize, Kentucky bluegrass is a fairly shallow-rooted plant, particularly when it's young. You know, I think there was a study done that showed even on a mature stand, 75% of the roots are in the top 4 inches.
Okay.
Where, like a lot of our other grasses, the roots go a little bit, you know, quite a bit deeper than that. So it won't take a lot of dry weather for the lawn to kind of dry out a little bit, and or it could be a little bit nitrogen starved.
Okay, I think it might be a combination of both. I wanted to maybe go a little lighter on the water to encourage some of that root growth.
But if it gets dry, see, one of these people don't realize is that if it dries, the soil dries below where the roots are and the water's not perking up, you know, through capillary action in the soil, if there's any dry space between the roots and where the water is, you know, the roots don't look at each other and say, hey, it looked like some water down there, let's go get it. It's got to have some moisture there.
Okay.
So, you know, you could cut back a little bit. But particularly that it's a new lawn that's not going to have deep roots, you want to make sure at least in the top 4 inches you've got adequate moisture.
Okay, now that we're in summer, it hasn't been a hot summer, but certainly warmer time of year. Will I be wasting water until we hit the cooler time of year to really promote that cool season growth? Should I wait until later in August to make sure it gets enough moisture again?
Yeah, I mean, clearly when air temperatures get in excess of 85 degrees, those bluegrass plants in general are not going to be, you know, actively growing. But if it's, you know, we've been having a fairly cool summer here.
Yeah, we have too.
Yeah, and we can't stop the damn grass from growing. Yeah. So, you know, in general, your theory is really good. In the summertime, it's best to allow the grasses to kind of go in and out of their natural dormancy cycle. Now, a lot of people try to force that, you know, because they want to have a perfectly green lawn all the time.
Right.
But your thinking is really sound in the sense that you look like, okay, it's not going to grow very much. I don't have to give it a lot of water. It's not going to be perfectly green. And then as soon as Labor Day comes, typically that's when the weather's change and you can, you know, return to actively good growth. So your thinking is right on there.
Okay. Now, what about just a couple more things? A weed and feed and then maybe an overseeding coming into the fall again, maybe mixing some fescues in it. I'm not sure I should have gone with all bluegrass, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, I would have said that generally if you don't have an in-ground irrigation system and you're not prepared to fertilize 3 to 4 times a year, mow regularly and stuff like that, then I don't think a bluegrass, 100% bluegrass, you know, because the problem is once you get those Kentucky bluegrass blends, you're really locked into maintaining them really well. And we've seen those kinds of lawns fail rapidly when they're not maintained properly. So I think it might be good to do some overseeding, but by all means, I would not use the weed and feed. Just use the fertilizer. I mean, if you see some broadleaf weeds coming in and you don't want them in there in October or late September, early October, then you go out with some spray and those ready-to-use formulas and you spot treat. By all means, and I would say this to all the people thinking about calling or listening, there is really very little need for most of you to be using weed and feed combinations. It's clearly two different times to do those things, and you can save a lot by not using the herbicide. Just put the fertilizer down. That should be all you need.
All right. Thanks, Nathan, for your call. Gary in Spring Grove, Minnesota, up to you now. Hi.
Hi. I've been trying to grow grass on a path through a shaded area through the forest.
Okay.
Without much success. And I had somebody suggest using a bent grass like on a golf course. The seed I used was a dense, shady mix.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that's critical about, you know, growing grass in the shade at all is that, you know, even the best grasses tolerate low light. Our rule of thumb is you need to have minimum 3 to 4 hours of some direct sunlight. And if it's a dense forest canopy, you know, that's going to be really hard to do. Now, if you're determined, the thing we'd recommend is that in this early spring, when the tree leaves aren't up yet, that you aggressively go in and seed those pads with either pure fine leaf fescue or tall fescue, which will do well in the shade and tolerate some traffic, realizing that over the course of the year, as the leaves come out on the trees, those pads are going to be difficult to maintain.
All right.
Okay, so a pure fine leaf or tall fescue, you said.
Right.
That's correct. And in the spring, before the tree leaves leaf, before the trees leaf out.
The idea of bent grass, is that?
No, that was a wrong choice.
Okay.
Bent grass has really poor shade tolerance.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We had some listeners who've called in who missed the details on the mole removal, and as I remember, what the caller said, and he was very successful with this, was to get a rat trap and put some bacon in it, some smoked bacon.
Bacon grease.
And you go to a tunnel, one of the mole tunnels, and you dig a hole out, put the rat trap down next to the hole, and then cover the whole thing with a tub of some sort, and just leave it sit, and the mole's going to smell that bacon and grease and going to come back and wham.
Wham is right.
And I think the original caller had gotten a dozen of them or something that way. So usually you don't find that many moles in a lawn. Usually there's just a few.
Yeah, well, what it sounds like, he may be attracting some of his neighbor's moles.
Yeah. Because
I think one of the keys that he said, and it makes sense, that by covering, you know, the bacon grease or the bacon, it doesn't allow, you know, that odor. You know how it permeates your house when you cook it, and everybody
right.
loves it.
Yeah.
It kind of permeates the tunnels, and that kind of attracts them. So he may be attracting them from your house, Larry.
I wish somebody would. I'm going to give this a try myself, and I will report on the results. All right, let's go to Deb in Milwaukee. Deborah, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I think he's attracting some of the neighbors.
Yeah, I think so.
Anyway, I had one comment, but now after listening for the past 10 minutes, I have a few. But, you know, when I walk through the parks, I took a bike ride through a park yesterday, and I see a lot of grasses growing in very shaded areas, and they're really bright green. So I'm thinking people could get ideas for what kinds of grass they want to grow in, you know, by just taking walks out in the woods, because you don't have to have a lot of sunlight for a lot of grass. And then moss is beautiful also. I think moss
yeah.
is gorgeous. But
moss is great, but it's not going to tolerate you walking on it.
Oh, really?
No.
It's not going to tolerate the traffic at all. It works really well between stones in a path in the woods, but once you start walking on it, it is not going to tolerate.
Oh, I'm thinking, when I think of walking on moss, I'm thinking barefoot, which I don't do very often, but if I had a moss garden or yard, I would. But I'm on the same page. What I wanted to comment about is I'm on the same page as the ground ivy guy about like 20 minutes ago. I think ground ivy is beautiful. I think purple, can you imagine a purple lawn? Everybody would like to come and look at it. And now I'm looking at our lawn, and it's parched, and it's, you know, it hasn't been watered, and the only green parts are where there's no sun or where the ivy, ground ivy is. And so, and it also has, I have a Peterson's Field Guide medicinal plant book, and it acts ground ivy gill over the ground. It's called Glaucoma heterarchia, and its medicinal properties are traditionally leaf tea used for lung ailments, asthma, jaundice, kidney ailments, blood purifier, externally a folk remedy for cancer, back aches and bruises, and piles.
Oh, my goodness. What do you think, Frank?
I think that guy making the beer needs to call in so we can start selling this stuff.
Right. Deborah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, medicinal values. Let's go to Dennis in Waukesha. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. Hey, I had a question about these fine leaf fescues. Is there a particular name for these fine leaf fescues that you can use in a NOMO situation? And do I have to, like, kill off the lawn that I have to be able to grow? I have 4.5 acres. I don't mow all of it. I keep a couple of it in conservancy, about 1.5 acres in conservancy. You know, it's a property that used to be a farm, and mostly what I have in my yard was pasture
yeah.
before.
Right.
You know,
now,
and I mow a lot of it to keep it looking nice for the neighborhood. But I got to tell you, you know, the hours that I spend on the mower could better be spent doing other things.
Yeah.
Amen to that. And my wife will remind you, I'm like the shoemaker's. my lawn is like the shoemaker's kids that always have holes in them. Right.
Right.
I don't think anybody in general would. You know, I like riding a lawnmower, but yes, there are certainly other things I'd like to be doing. But you're really...
I'd rather be fishing.
Yeah.
The really good question that I know a lot of people, I'm sure, are going to have, because here at Cornell, they had the question, yeah, it's really good, Frank, you want these fine fescues, and the specific ones that I'd like to see you use are primarily the hard and the sheep's fescues. The
Did
hard
you spell
fescues,
that last one?
The hard and sheep's fescue.
Like sheep?
Like baa sheep. Yep, sheep's fescue and hard fescue are the two most commonly found in these no-mow mixes? And there's a number of different varieties that, again, you can get through the Extension Service that they'll have recommended for Wisconsin. But
how do I overseed, or how do I get it going in my if I have an existing lawn?
Yeah, that's the perfect question. And what we've been fussing with, the little bit of demonstration work we've been doing, is trying to compare like spraying it out or other means of getting the grass established. And what we found to be the most successful approach is right in the spring, right around early mid-May, grass is about 4 to 6 inches high. A lot of the weeds have already established themselves a little bit. We go in and we set our mower at like an inch.
Yeah.
And we go out and we scalp it almost right to the ground.
Right.
And then we blow the debris off. And
yeah.
Then we just went and spread the seed. And I tell you, I was shocked. We got almost 70%. Fescue established in these areas just by scalping what was there down to the ground. And as a matter of fact, in areas where we scalped but didn't seed, we also reduced weed growth a little bit.
Uh-huh. That makes sense.
There's something about that early season scalping that really sets back the vegetation that you can seed into, because the key to seeding is to get that seed in intimate contact with the soil.
Okay, so the thing is, you don't then cover it with anything.
No, nice and easy. We scalped it and we seeded it over the top of it after we blew the debris off. And so you've got to get that debris off, otherwise it'll really kind of create a soil seed problem. And when it stays on, it kind of causes a kind of a mold problem
because
it holds too much moisture on the ground.
Right. And May is the best time.
Well, it's the time we did. I think you could do it just as well in September, but we haven't tested that yet.
There you have it, Dennis.
That sounds good to me because, in September, you still have a long growing season left.
Yeah. You could still. I don't see any reason why it wouldn't work in September.
Now, if you did it in September and you came back the following spring,
do it again.
What happens to that fescue if it winds up being mowed low, if you wanted to make a second pass at your lawn?
Generally, it'll be weakened. I don't know if I'd scalp it all the way down to the ground, but I'd bring it down a little bit, and any bare areas, I'd throw more fescue seed on.
Okay. Now, can I buy this seed bulk?
I think you can. You can go to any of your farm co-op places or commercial seed houses. I don't think a lot of your big box places are going to have these things. And you can go to Prairie Nursery right there in Wisconsin, Neil DeBole's place. I think it's prairienursery.com.
Yep.
And he sells no mow mix.
Yep.
Oh, that's perfect. Prairie Nursery.
Yes.
Have Neil on, Larry?
Oh, yeah. Neil's been a regular guest on the show over the years.
Yeah, he's one of the first guys that kind of started doing this 15, 16 years ago when I was out there. He got me thinking about it, and lo and behold, everybody's coming around to it now.
Yeah. Neil does a great job.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dennis, for calling. I want to give Dave in Park Falls a chance. Dave, hi to you.
Hi. Hi right back to you, Larry. Hey, listen, I've got a question. I had my lawn put in. We live on a lake property up here, and it's been called a gravel bar by the National Forest Service people. It's an old glacial, lots of sand, lots of rocks. And so they spread the topsoil on, before they seeded it. But, guess what? I don't think we have near enough topsoil. So needless to say, it drains exceedingly well. And what I wonder is there any way that you can kind of build the topsoil up from the top down? Is there any way you can mulch or do something so that I can gradually build this topsoil up so it holds the moisture better?
I think something similar to what I said to a previous caller, if you have access to good quality compost and can incorporate that into the topsoil that they've brought in there, I believe that is going to be one way to really have a healthy soil that you can grow grass on.
But, I mean, I already have a lawn on it. It's just not very healthy because there's not much topsoil there. Is there any way that I can, I don't know, mulch that lawn or do something to add topsoil and have the grass grow through it so I don't have to reseed?
Yes, you reseed. I mean, if you want to, the only way to build it up is to apply material over the top, and you'd have to do that in a, you know, in a kind of a uniform fashion that dispersed it evenly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could do it. I mean, if they sell big compost spreaders that you walk behind, they're rotary spreaders, and if the compost is well shredded, it'll go through it, and you can spread that right over the top of your lawn.
Oh, okay. Could you even do that with topsoil itself?
You could, but you got to get one of those big hopper spreaders. There's a, oh, I'm trying to think of what it's called, but I would Google like compost spreader, home compost spreader, and you'll find one. It's got a big hopper and very big holes for the compost or topsoil to flow through.
Okay. And also, is there a drought tolerant or, you know, a grass that I may want to think about overseeding that would be a little more drought tolerant than what I have now, which I think is bluegrass?
Yeah. I mean, again, the family of fine leaf fescues would do well. Or if you really wanted to change the grass that you're growing there, I think tall fescue would do well. Very deep rooted, very drought tolerant, could hold up to some traffic. It'll root down into that gravel, probably. These grasses root. Matter of fact, we've been doing some work putting tall fescue over the top of this stuff called structural soil, which to me looks like gravel, but it's gravel mixed with soil, and we're developing some green parking lots where taking some Walmart parking lots and some of the areas that don't get parked on a lot. They're basically gravel, and we're putting tall fescue sod over the top of that, and it's growing really well.
And I could overseed with that, huh?
You could, yes.
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. And Marcia in New Auburn, hi.
Hello. I just have a quick comment about something you were talking about a while ago about the two-stroke lawnmowers and the gentleman saying it was minimal pollution. It just made me think about if we go into a national park and say, well, I'm just taking one rock, but there's a million people that visit that park every year, and they all take a rock, it adds up. Sometimes we don't tend to think beyond our little selves.
It's a good point, Frank.
Very good point. That's what we were trying to say to that caller, I think, was individually, it may not be that big of a deal, but collectively it has an enormous impact. And I just really feel like, you know, there's this old environmental saying that people used to use, you know, think globally, act locally. And I think there's nothing more local. You know, a lot of people think they help the environment by shipping the money off to Greenpeace or a lot of organizations that probably do really good work. But that same money spent around your home and in your community can also do also good work. And I think, you know, we keep facing these environmental issues in the future, I think local involvement, I think each of us contributing is really going to be the solution, not simply, you know, taking money, giving it to some organization and have them try to solve the problems. I believe collectively we'll solve those problems, on an individual basis better than just some organization will do on a large scale basis.
And Frank, with that, we have to close. Thank you so much. It's been a great joy.
It's great chatting with you, Larry. I miss the days of being able to walk over there and see you.
All right. Frank Rossi, associate professor from Cornell University's Department of Horticulture, on this edition of Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network.